Good morning, Pittsburgh diners and travelers, and good afternoon to our overseas listeners, and good morning to Peter.
Good morning, good morning. And we have a guest on the line already.
Yes, dear friend, Paula Lambert, how are you?
I am great. How are you?
Great. Paula, you started this company in 1982. When I read the date, I thought, I just can't believe it was that long ago. Paula is from Dallas, and she started the mozzarella company. And she's made cheeses. She's won awards all over the place. Instead of just mozzarella, you branched out. You send us some samples of some goat cheese, which was fabulous.
But how did you get the idea to start? This is not exactly a straight shot.
You mean you don't think of Dallas as being the cheese capital of the world?
not hardly. And if it was, I don't think it would be mozzarella.
Well, I had lived in Italy for 5 years studying Italian and art history before I got married.
Oh, you too. Another art historian turned foodie. We're all there. Ruth
yes,
Reichel is too.
I didn't know that about you.
Yeah, I was. Yeah.
Oh. Well, I had lived there, and I loved everything Italian, and I decided that I wanted to have a business that involved Italy and food, and I came up with the idea of fresh mozzarella because no one had even heard of it in Dallas in 1982.
No, I bet only 1% of the population's heard of it now, and they're all your customers.
Well, anyway, so we started I learned how to make the cheese in Italy, and then started making it here and introduced people to it. And over the years, we've just added more and more different cheeses, fresh cheeses and aged cheeses made from cow's milk and goat's milk.
Yeah, I love that, the goat's milk cheese you sent.
Well, thanks. It was goat cheese wrapped in a leaf that's called Hoja Santa. It
what
means
is that?
Holy leaf or sacred leaf.
Oh, okay.
And it's used in Mexico for wrapping fish and chicken that they steam in banana leaves.
Oh, that's funny, because when I tasted it, I looked at it and I said it must be wrapped in grape leaves, and when I tasted it, it didn't taste like grape leaves.
That's right, and this flavor, it has the flavor of sassafras
okay. And
anise, and so that flavor of that leaf just permeates the cheese.
Well, now, when you started out making cheese, I mean, was there a cheese-making tradition in Texas at all?
No, not I couldn't find it if it was here. No, I learned everything in Italy. And then after I opened, I found out about Laura Chanel, who had just started making goat cheese in California.
Right.
And
yeah.
There was a girl up in Massachusetts called Letty Kilmoyer, uh-huh. And she was making Hubbardston Blue, which was that log that had the blue mold on the outside of goat cheese.
Right.
And there was someone in Illinois, but there were just so few people making cheese.
And now look at the explosion.
I know. We're having a slow food event next week here in Dallas with 14 Texas cheesemakers.
Really?
Yeah.
My goodness.
Well, you know, John Fultz is making cheese in New Orleans.
Yeah, Louisiana.
I know.
Yeah, we talked to him about that, and as he explained it, there was a long cheesemaking tradition in Louisiana when it was a French colony, and that was what he overturned, and it's what gave him the idea.
Creole cream cheese, which was a traditional thing down there.
Well, we just got back from various Southern food and wine festivals, including the Charleston, South Carolina.
Oh, did you see Natalie?
Yeah, so I love Natalie. Yeah, she's great.
Great. They invited me to go, but I just couldn't go. I'd love to go there.
Well, it was good. We went to the South Beach one, and were not impressed at all. I mean, they 30,000 people, and they didn't even have a press room.
Oh, no. Well,
yeah.
It's gotten really big.
But the Charleston was perfect. It was just great. Great chefs,
yeah.
Great people.
I
don't understand that cream cheese pimento thing.
Oh, you mean pimento cream cheese?
That's whatever that is. They call it pimento cheese.
I haven't had that. Does it come from Charleston?
Yeah, it's apparently very popular in that area.
Yeah, it's made with some kind of inexpensive cheese product. And
I thought it was cheddar, actually.
Mayonnaise and pimento peppers.
Well, I have a recipe in my book for making pimento cheese sandwiches. Which
is that in this book?
In my new book.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking at right
now.
And
that's the way that's pretty much the way you make it. That's an old Southern recipe.
It is Southern, then. I thought so, yeah. Now, Paula, you wrote originally the Cheese Lover's Cookbook and Guide, and now your new book that we're going to be discussing is Cheese, Glorious Cheese, where you have more than 75 tempting recipes for cheese lovers. Hello?
Hello,
yes.
I do.
And I have, I think that Mr. Peter Rabbit must have marked this one, the grilled leg of lamb with dilled goat cheese sauce. It sounds great.
I love to create these recipes. And there's so many wonderful ways to do cheese. And you can be creative and come up with wonderful ideas. Not all the recipes have to have just goopy amounts of cheese. You can just use a little sprinkling of cheese here and there and make everything better.
Oh, I think some of these recipes are just perfect.
Well, thank you.
You know, the corn salad and radicchio cups.
Yes, that's very colorful.
Yeah, I bet it would be. We're trying to grow radicchio. It turns out green and bitter, and then apparently you brush away the snow. And it's red. I mean, I don't know.
By the time we got to that part, the ground was frozen solid. So I think the radicchio didn't complete its life very satisfactorily.
Well, they're different strains of radicchio. There's like Radicchio di Treviso, and then
are
other kinds. So a long time ago, I used to buy those seeds from that wonderful Shepherd Seed Company.
Oh, yes. I got those, too.
Yeah.
I think that might have been where we got them from, but I planted them, and I forgot what I put in where, and we didn't know what it was, so we ate the leaves that sprouted anyway, but then I decided it must be a radicchio, and it had to be sort of snowed on before it was perfect, and then the snow went to ice, and that was the end of it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Now tell me this, Paula, the photography is just absolutely brilliant in this book.
Thank you.
I'm looking at pork tenderloin with smoked cheddar tortilla stuffing.
Yes, they did a luncheon for me at the Modern Museum in Fort Worth this week, and this was the luncheon entree, and I had forgotten how delicious it is, because you have this two ways of enjoying corn stuffed inside this pork tenderloin. You have the flavor of the corn from the tortilla as well as the roasted corn, and it just goes together really well.
Yeah, and then the other one I thought was the croissant filled with scrambled eggs, tomatoes, and dilled Havarti.
Yes, that's a perfect luncheon or breakfast dish, I think.
Yeah, no. So you use cheeses in this cookbook that you don't yourself make.
Yes, no, they're all cheeses that you can find at the grocery store. It's not a lot of exotic cheeses. It's cheese that you can find.
Uh-huh.
So I think that's very important.
Yeah. How about giving us we'll put this on our website so people can order from our website here. But otherwise, do you have a website you'd like to pet?
We do. Our website is Mozzco, MOZZCO.com, and that's short for Mozzarella Company.
Right.
So,
You didn't bring the buffalo here, though, did you?
No. You know, I was the first person in the United States that made buffalo mozzarella from water buffalo milk.
Did you really?
And it was a while back. I mean, I bet about 15 years ago. And there was a man in Texarkana, which is on the border of Texas and Arkansas, and he had some water buffalo that he was milking. But he has since sold his herd, and there's no more water buffalo milk in these parts.
And somebody is milking
there's
buffalo.
A man in L.A., outside of
is
L.A.,
it there?
And then
okay.
They were also making water buffalo mozzarella up in Woodstock, Vermont. But I think that they have now decided to make mostly yogurt, but I'm not sure.
Huh. We have a funny story about that, Paula, that I inject very quickly. The first time we went to Campania, in Italy, which, of course, is the home of buffalo mozzarella, there are signs for it everywhere, but we never saw any buffalo.
Oh.
And we wondered where they were. And then on another trip to the same region, we did see some. And the reason we didn't see them in the fields is apparently they keep them in sheds.
Oh, yes, and they're quite pampered.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty interesting, but that is true. Originally, buffalo mozzarella came from down around Naples and in Campania. But in the 60s and 70s, they took a lot of the water buffalo up to northern Italy.
Really?
And so the industrial water buffalo is made closer to the Po River Valley, but the artisanal water buffalo mozzarella is made down around Naples.
Huh. Right near that. What's the name of that?
It's called Battipaglia.
No, there's a place.
Pestum Caserta.
That's it. Pestum is the one I was thinking of.
Pestum. Mm-hmm.
Pestum is that gorgeous Greek
ruin.
Temple.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The beautiful temple. The first time I saw it wasn't nearly as complete as it is now.
I know. Well, that's the joy of getting to go back more than once.
Right. Now, give us, how many types of cheese do you have total now?
We make about 20 or 30 different kinds of cheese, and you can go to our website and see them all. Many are Italian in inspiration, but they're also cheeses that I've created. I've visited cheese factories in Italy and France and Spain and Greece and Mexico and been very influenced by a lot of these traditional cheese-making techniques. And so I've taken what I've learned there and come back to Dallas and created recipes for these various cheeses.
Now, Paula, what's your distribution like? I mean, if listeners that are in all parts of the country...
Yes, we distribute everywhere. We sell both to restaurants and to gourmets and
specialty shops,
food stores.
Now, are you not scheduled to be in Pittsburgh doing a class pretty
soon? I'm coming to Crate, and I've been there before.
She's a very dear
Linda
friend of ours.
Linda is so nice.
Linda Wernikoff, yeah.
Yes,
love her.
And I'll be there on June 18th. It's a Monday. And I'm going to be making a whole bunch of dishes out of my new book, and it's going to be fun.
That's great.
I really enjoyed being there in the past.
Now, if you have appearances elsewhere, they're also on the website, Paula?
We have a little calendar on our website down at the bottom of the main page, and it talks about where I'll be when.
That's good, yeah.
So you're quite a disciple of cheese.
I am.
Yeah. What do you think of artisanal, the place where they finish the cheeses in New York?
I think it's fabulous. They're a big customer of ours.
Oh, are they? That's good.
Yes, and in fact, the cheese that this is a place where they do affinage, which
means
that they take a young cheese and they age it to make it have more flavor and become somewhat different. And the goat cheese that I sent you, the goat cheese wrapped in Hoja Santa, is one of the cheeses that they take and age.
Okay.
And so you can order it from Artisanal online, and you can also, they distribute to lots of restaurants up and down around New York. And so often you can find our cheese on the menu in many restaurants in New York, and I bet in Philadelphia, because they're distributed by Artisanal.
Now, did you happen to taste Terrence Brennan's cheesecake that won the NAFS Award last year?
No, but wasn't it gorgeous?
Oh, I couldn't. It was just amazing. I don't even like sweets, and I just thought this was knock your socks off.
Well, I saw that photograph, and it just was magnificent, but I didn't get to taste it.
Oh, yeah. Well, they had samplings at the Fancy Food Show.
Uh-huh.
So. Well, we're fresh back from London, where we saw the incredibly prosperous Neil's Yard cheese shop.
Oh, yes.
Right near the Borough Market.
Yes, that's a wonderful place, and Randolph is such a great guy.
Oh, is he the owner?
Yes, Randolph Hogson.
Okay. Do we know him? I don't know if we do.
We met their marketing person one time when we were there, and
it was a woman.
The last time, one of the days you were confined to bed, I did go over to the.
Would you believe I got food poisoning on this last trip to London?
Oh no! How terrible!
Well, it's an occupational hazard, you know. Yeah.
Well, so it's very bad.
No, there was a man in the street giving away cubes of Montgomery cheddar, which is Max McCowman's second favorite cheese, I think.
I think that is delicious. You know, that Montgomery cheddar, it's a farmstead. So they raise the animals and they make the cheddar there. And, you know, a lot of times it's cracked and they get little blue veins in it.
Right.
And instead of throwing away the cheese because it has the blue mold, it's marketed as being the best and most special.
Uh-huh. Now, we have to take a break. Could you hang on for a minute?
I'd love to.
Great. So we'll take a break now. Welcome back. Don't forget to check our website. It's www.onthemenuradio.com. And you can see pictures of us. We can see pictures of our new grandbaby.
Pictures of all kinds of people. We have a new picture of Anne in New Orleans that was just added to the site just the other day.
Right. So, but anyhow, we spent the last segment talking to Paula Lambert about her cheese. She's president and founder of the Mozzarella Company in Dallas, and also about her new book, which is wonderful, Cheese, Glorious Cheese, the wonderful recipes in there for using cheese, and I know you like cheese.
I'm a cheese fan of the first order.
Exactly. And the new voice on the line is Ed Harrell, who is president, he's many things, but he is also president of the Pittsburgh Wine Festival. Am I correct with that, Ed?
That is correct.
So I thought we're going to eventually end up talking about this wine festival, but I wanted to launch off while we had Paula on the phone with a brief discussion about the pairing of wine and cheese. Peter, you explain what you
I actually read an opinion that you have to be very careful serving cheese with wine because cheese can, in fact, mask the nuances of the flavors of the wine, so you have to be very careful about that. On the other hand, other people say wine and cheese go great together. So there's one controversial element. The second controversial element is what kind of wine we drink with cheese. Some people think you should always pair cheese with red wine. Other people say no, red wine and cheese fight with each other, so you should serve even sweet wines, but certainly white wines with cheese. So what do you think about that, Ed?
I think that the cheeses are as varied as wine. It was Charles de Gaulle, I believe, who said that when asked why he couldn't do a better job of controlling France after the end of the war, said you can't control a country that has 225 cheeses. And I think if you look at the cheeses as individual entities and look at the wine as individual entities, you're not really talking about what goes with what. You're talking about matching off various tastes because the cheeses are as varied as the wines.
Right.
And, there are a couple of companies in France that export lessons in that. They will send you five or six cheeses overnight, and they'll put a bottle of white and a bottle of red in there, and they talk you through pairing these up, and some they just openly say, does not go with this cheese. So it's fun to taste. It's fun to develop that palate. But I don't think there are any hard, fast rules.
Yeah. Paula, what do you say?
Well, I totally agree. We do wine and cheese pairing classes at the Mozzarella Company all the time, and as well as beer and cheese pairing classes. And there are so many variations. I mean, just because a wine is a Sauvignon Blanc, it can come from so many regions of the world, and that is just great that's involved. And so it's going to go with a cheese that's of a similar acidity and a similar weight. But there's so much variation between the different cheeses of one type and the different wines of another, and it works out to be everyone's personal preference, actually.
Now, there is another concept at work that I've heard about and that we could probably extend into this department. And Ed, you may have heard this and experienced the same thing, in a lot of regions of the world where the cuisine has been there for a long time, a smart thing to do is to drink wines of the region with food from the region, because they naturally seem to go together.
Of course.
So
I
that's mean, always
why,
a good guideline.
Why would you argue with Burgundy, who has been eating époisse with their wines for 200 years.
I know. You're exactly right on that.
But if you're in the region where they make Roquefort, then Burgundy is not nearby, so...
Well, no, but they make wine there.
They
I've
sure
been
do.
There. They make wine there.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. We drank some from the region when we were there, and we had four or five kinds of Roquefort at the same time.
Exactly.
Right.
And so I think that it really is... I mean, if you really want to look at it, there are several hundred years of... practice that when you finally run through all that, then you can, I guess, be more experimental. But
right.
There are a lot of people who've already done the work for you.
Right.
here's a dangerous thing, Ed. We just got back from England, and thanks to global warming or whatever else is going on, winemaking is springing up all over England. So
I read that, and it's a horrible idea.
But you have to have wine to drink with Stilton.
I suppose.
Well, they have port. You know, that port has always been exported from Portugal to England. Doesn't England consume more port than any place in the world?
Oh, absolutely. They're
also huge consumers of French wines.
That's right.
You're perfectly right, Paula. The trade in port wine was almost exclusively from Portugal to England. And it's for that reason, I think, that Portugal is considered England's oldest ally.
Well, in Lisbon, they have that square where the traffic goes around in the style of England rather than the style of the continent.
You mean roundabout?
Yes. Not the roundabout. It's a square in the center of town.
Oh, okay.
Well, I love England, but I have to say that they're not renowned for their cuisine.
Oh, no.
They have wonderful restaurants, but they have wonderful restaurants now because the rest of Europe has built restaurants there.
No, they have wonderful natural products there, which is, I just can't tell you how much artisanal produce we've had there.
And a great generation.
Cheese. Cheeses are extraordinary.
But there was a time they could take those artisanal products and turn them into something inedible.
My mother knew how to do that real well. fortunately, she's not listening to the program.
Yeah. Well, now, listen, Paula, just before you go off, I'd like for you to repeat your website.
Yes, it's Mozzco, MOZZCO.com. And we have cheese and wine pairing suggestions on our website.
Okay.
So I hope people will go there and see what we say.
Right. Well, that's terrific.
Your new book is Cheese, Glorious Cheese, and I think it's a wonderful book. It's just, Ed, you'd like this book. It's cheese, but it's not like just swamped with it. You know, it's very, very creative and modern.
I look forward to seeing it.
Yeah, and we're going to put that on
it at Barnes & Noble.
Well, we're going to put it on our website. You can just get it right off of our website.
All right.
And good luck with your wine and food festival. Sounds great.
Thanks, Paula.
Well, it is great. And you should come up and help me taste some of these things. We have 125 vintners coming, and they're going to pour about 4 wines each, and we have to make sure none of it's bad, don't we?
Well, for sure. When is it?
April 26th.
Oh, sounds great. Yeah, well, I hope I can come sometime.
All right.
Paula, thank you so much, and I look forward to hearing about your visit to Pittsburgh on June 19th, is it?
June 18th.
June 18th. Great.
Yes, thanks, Anne.
Thank you so much, Paula.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, Monsieur le Président de la Pittsburgh Wine Festival. We already got the date in, but that's not all that's going on. It's a very busy week.
Hey, Ed, yeah. I just found something. I'm doing a piece for Fanfare Quarterly on wine tastings in Pittsburgh. Oh, we lost him.
No, I'm here.
Oh, okay.
I don't know what that.
Ed's not there.
We're gonna have the producer hang up the line.
Yeah, but anyhow, I know there's a new group. Have you heard about this new group in Pittsburgh? It's called Yens du Vin.
Yens du Vin, yes. In fact, they came to me and wanted to do something at the wine festival.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not sure what to have them do yet. Do you think we could? We think we can get Annie Greensprings and maybe a couple of fortified wines there.
I don't know what they do. I've never been to one of theirs. It's called
They're just
progressive
wine tasters, but they enjoy the idea that they somehow. Yinzers too.
I see. All right. I see. So have you been? Do you know anything?
I have not, no.
Okay.
We got rid of the beep, beep, beep.
Yeah, okay. So now let's start from scratch. Tell us about the wine festival.
Well, the wine festival starts on April 21st with a dinner at the Carlton restaurant. And
Kevin Joyce.
Clinton's.
Oh, President Clinton.
Former White House chef.
Oh, that's right, Shrive.
Going to be there, and he's going to be leading the menu and the cooking. And I don't know the winery yet. We're working on that right now. But that will be the kickoff lead event for the festival. We will also have a wine auction there that night for a number of travel events and things, and the results of the auction will benefit University of Pittsburgh Medical Center Cancer Institute.
Cancer Institute, right.
So that's exciting, and those reservations can be made by calling the Carlton directly. and they are quickly lining up. I think by next week probably we'll have the menu and the wine selections up on the internet at our website, which is www.pittsburghwinefestival.com.
Okay.
And
Pittsburgh spelled out.
Yes, Pittsburgh is spelled out. It's an exercise in typing, but you get it all in. Yeah.
And the food and are also spelled out.
Yes.
It's a long website. Try typing that without making a mistake.
Exactly.
So, okay, move us along
Monday night,
we
have a seminar that Marnie Old is doing on how to select wine. And then we are also working on an event. It hasn't been finalized yet with WQED called Wine and Chocolate.
Yeah, I read about that.
Which we will be putting together. And that also will be announced in about 2 weeks on the website. Then Tuesday and Wednesday are dinners around town. We have some dinners in private homes. There are six of those, and they will be by invitation of the hostess. And they are raising money at the private dinners also for the cancer center. We're excited about that because this year we expect to raise over $1 million at the dinner.
Wow.
To benefit the cancer center.
That's fabulous.
And then area restaurants, about 10 area restaurants, will also have dinners that people can access by calling the restaurants directly. But we'll have the entire list up in about a week and a half on our website so that you can go in and take your pick. We'll have the menus, and you can look at what you think you might want to do.
Now, the restaurant dinners, are they all Wednesday night, Ed?
Most of them will be Wednesday night, and maybe one or two that get over into Tuesday.
Okay,
but Wednesday night is logical because the winemakers are coming into town anyway.
Great. Now let's go on to Thursday because there are...
Thursday really is a big event.
It's a two-stage event, though, right?
Yes. Thursday is a big event. It's at Heinz Field, and we have over 125 wineries already signed up to come in. Each one will pour about four wines, and it's in two stages. The first stage we call our VIP stage because we only let about 600 people in. And that's at 5 o'clock, and tickets are $250 each. But you get a lot of private time with the winemakers before anyone else gets to come in. Then another 1,000 people will come in at 6:30, and that will go on till 9 o'clock. That's called the grand tasting, and that ticket is $125. Again, all the proceeds for any excess of a cost of running the festival go to the hospital. We'll also have a solid auction there, and we usually have some rather entertaining forms of entertainment around the building. You may remember the vines from last year.
Oh, the vines, right. I forgot about them. We actually had food last year. I mean, the first year I thought I was going to starve to death.
Oh, well, no. You'll have more food this year to choose from.
Yeah, and then after I carried on about it, you got rid last time of the hot pepper cheese cubes. I thought that was wonderful. Listen, Ed, could you hang on so we can take a break, and then we'll be right back.
Okay.
We're talking to Ed Harrell, president of the Pittsburgh Wine Festival, a grand event that is in its what year, Ed?
This is the fifth year.
Fifth year.
And it's the sixth year in Philadelphia, but ours is always better, right?
Ours is always better. Just ask anybody.
No, that's been the comment every year with the people from the PLCB who are here. They say the Philadelphia one is good, but the Pittsburgh one is better.
Exactly. And we had just talked about what goes on Thursday, and then Friday, Slow Foods is doing an event.
Oh, yeah. Now, how does that work in there?
Well, they're having their event in Lawrenceville, and they're putting the foods together, and I'm working on getting some regional wineries to participate in that. So
yeah, I was trying to get excited about the regional wineries, but I know it's good.
I don't think anything's going to improve there until we all say, okay, we're going to support it and try to make it, you know, we want you guys to do more there. There are actually a couple of wineries in Pennsylvania, I think, that are making very representative product now, and there's no reason they can't do something. I think they're not going to be great Pinot Noir producers probably, but I don't know any reason that they can't do some other varietals that that would give them a real niche in the marketplace. So
no,
we have to encourage them.
I read a very good review of Chadsford Winery, which is down on the way between, I guess it's on the back way between Philadelphia and Wilmington, Delaware.
Yes, I've been there. I know the winemakers well, and they're making a very, very good product.
Now, you know, one of my favorite things last year was that champagne tasting. Are you having anything like that?
I don't know yet. And
we've
tried to get Charles Curtis back, but he's got some conflicts and we don't know what he's going to
do. Yeah, so he was good, and it was a small enough group so
right.
that it was more intimate than the swarms.
Yeah, we did.
Had a good experience here. He did that, and because he did it, French television picked up.
Really?
Picked him up and did a show in Champagne that they broadcast throughout France on his doing his wines.
Well, he was broadcast around the world on the menu too.
Yeah.
We did a recording with him.
Well, you know, we just did another. We did a fabulous tasting at the Charleston Food and Wine Festival. What's his name, Perrin?
Oh, with Mark Perrin from Bocastel.
Right.
And he was so, I don't know, he was eloquent. He was approachable, accessible, intelligent.
He was
very, very extraordinary.
He was extraordinary.
Peter sounded like she fell in love.
No, he was extraordinarily knowledgeable.
He's very cute also.
And the funniest thing is I had reached a conclusion, and then I had a discussion with someone that turned into an argument about the 2002 Chateauneuf-du-Pape from Bocastel. And he said, we didn't make any. He said, we put all the best grapes that would ordinarily have gone into Bocastel, we put that into their second wine, which is called Coup de l'Eau de Bocastel. And apparently it's across the road. The wines aren't any different, but it's actually across the road from where you can call it Chateauneuf-du-Pape. Other than that, it's practically identical.
There are a number of those dirty little secrets in France.
Well, I was talking to a local wine connoisseur, and he said, no, they wouldn't do that. It's quite different.
Well, I just bought a case of the 2005 Bordeaux that's next door to Margaux.
There you go. I'm sure.
And for all practical purposes, Robert Parker says there's no difference in the soil. So.
I see.
So it's probably going to be good, huh?
Yeah, I suspect so. This is a great year for wine in France.
I was reading Decanter Magazine, the new issue that just came today, because 2 years ago, I interviewed the estate manager from Oprion.
Ah, yes.
And he was telling me that the 2003 vintage, which was, I think they picked their grapes in August.
Right.
And he said it was going to be a fabulous vintage, and I just read a review in Decanter that said that 2003s were turning out to be much too rich and boggy and not nearly interesting, and 2005 was now going to be a great year. So I think you probably made a good buy.
I think so. Everybody's telling me that you could probably throw a dart into the wine map in Burgundy, and you couldn't go wrong.
Right. Now, you know, when we were just at the South Beach Food and Wine Festival and at the Charleston Food and Wine Festival, people came from all over to those festivals. Do we draw a lot of people from distances outside of Pittsburgh?
Yes, we do. Last year we had about 300 people come in from what I would consider long-distance destinations. At least the tickets were purchased from there.
Uh-huh.
And I know that this year already we are up to that number. So my guess is we're going to have more like 500 or 600 ticket purchases from outside this region. Even amazing number from New York.
Oh, that's great! Now we have to do some. We have to work on the food program some more.
Yes, we do. It's a difficult thing. Always trying to balance. For that one event, you know, trying to balance something that's not going to overpower the wines. But yes, we would like to have more food represented in the entire festival. Each year I work with the Food Channel and try to do something with that. But I can't say that I have had met the kind of success I'd like to have.
Well, I tell you, we'll give you some information about the Charleston Festival. It's in its second year, and they had an excellent group of visiting chefs teamed up with local chefs doing dine-arounds that were really quite outstanding.
Great.
So it can be done. Whether or not Pittsburgh will find it as easy as Charleston, being such an attractive destination from a tourist standpoint, I guess it's hard for us to know, but we did have a chance to go to school on that, so we'll have the opportunity.
Great, I'd love to hear about it. I have made my pledge to myself that I'm starting almost immediately after this one to go after the food side, because most of the excuses I get are pre-bookings and things like that.
You have to start a long time in advance, right?
Right. Yeah, and
give me a call
from
that.
Now become the new rock stars. So, you know,
yeah.
You're all of a sudden talking to their agents.
But give me a call. I mean, I have a number of connections with that.
Okay, I'd love it.
So you have my number.
I do.
Okay, we ought to be able to work something with that. We did have this, the South Beach. There's another point here that I guess they had 30,000 people,
mm-hmm.
and we went as media, of course, and there was not a press room available. Now, they had a press room in Charleston, and it made all the difference in the world in coordinating interviews.
I'm sure.
And 30,000 people, and every time you went to a different venue, you had to be recredentialed. It was a nightmare.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they had the bubble queue. They sold out at $300 a head, and the event tickets were scalped for $600. And the people crowded in, and Al Roker was hosting this, and halfway through the event, they ran out of champagne.
Ooh, ugly!
It got ugly.
that could cause a riot.
We don't know how it was ugly. We were stuck in the American Airlines basketball arena trying to get ourselves food and wine, and compared to that, Heinz Field is just an absolutely wonderful space.
Well, I think it's a great space. We've looked all around town, and I can't seem to come up with anything that compares to it. So,
well, I guess there isn't a place that has that size, is there? I mean, is it
the size, the view of the city,
the view is great, yeah.
The ambiance all together is just a very nice location for the event.
Well, the information again, listeners, is www.PittsburghFoodAndWineFestival.
Whoa, Peter. Oops. www.PittsburghWineFestival.com.
Pittsburgh Wine,
there
you
go. We keep wishful thinking.
Yeah, I'm making
it. Among the some of us who are sometimes challenged by a computer, they can call 412-281-2681, and we'll take the reservation on the phone. But if you go to the computer, you can not only make your reservation, you can print your ticket out this year. So,
that's great. That's a clever idea.
Yeah, so you get the whole package, and it's there waiting for you.
And everybody, don't waste time, because all this stuff sells out really fast.
Yes, it
does. Pittsburgh is an extraordinary wine.
Now, so, yeah.
Yeah. See, Pittsburgh is an extraordinary wine town. Yeah. So if anybody's really interested in going, you better get right on there, and I guess everything will be up in a week, right?
Just about everything should be up, yeah. We've got most of the dates set, and I'm just waiting to get the graphics done.
And failing anything else, you can send us an email to onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com, and we'll pass it along, or we'll send the information back to you ourselves.
All right.
And, Ed, we'll look forward to seeing you on the 26th, if not at the events ahead of or behind it.
Well, I hope so. I'll be running around like the proverbial chicken with his head cut off that day. But you can just breeze right by, grab me, and say hello.
We will. you can do the same.
Okay.
And thank you so much for joining us. And we wish you well with all the final preparations. We're looking forward to seeing the final details online as soon as they're there. So that we can plan our activities for that week.
And I want to go to Argentina. Why don't we go to Argentina?
We might go to Argentina.
Well, call me before you do. I had some great experiences there.
Well, we will call you.
Okay.
Okay, Ed. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So anyhow, well, this is going to be exciting. Anybody who's thinking of going, be prepared to run into everybody you know in the city of Pittsburgh, because everybody goes.
Yep, everybody goes. We're going to take a break.
We ought to take a break now. Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We're going to take you along with us to our recent visit to London. We're going to listen to some recordings we did with the chef at a wonderful restaurant called Arbutus.
Arbutus. What a wonderful, smart new restaurant. Recipient of I don't know how many awards. Will Smith, co-owner. Explain to us the concept of this restaurant.
I've been working with Anthony for about 10 years, and over that time we've been able to put together our ideas of what we think makes a great restaurant.
Anthony, of course, being your partner and chef.
Anthony being my business partner and is also the chef, exactly, and the man who comes up with the wonderful dishes that we offer to our guests. Over that time we've worked in different styles of establishments, and we've decided that there are various things that we enjoy in restaurants and which we love in restaurants, which we think make great places to dine.
And I mentioned the awards. What awards have you won?
Well, we've had a phenomenal 8-9 months since we've opened. Most notably, I suppose, most recently we've won one Michelin star from the Michelin Guide, which is absolutely fantastic for the business. We've also won a Time Out London Best New Restaurant Award for last year. Tatler Restaurant of the Year Award, Remy Martin Best Newcomer of the Year for the UK, Good Food Guide Best Newcomer London. We've been really blessed with some fantastic awards, which has been amazing for our business.
Well, blessed may not be the exact term here. Let's talk to Anthony Dimitri, the chef. Give us a little of your background, Anthony.
Well, historically, I worked here 12 years ago when it was co-owned by one of my mentors, Bruno Lube. So historically, we knew that this site could be successful once again.
Where exactly are we? Maybe our listeners would want to know.
Well, we're in Soho, smack in the middle of Soho, towards Soho Square on Frick Street.
And the name Arbutus means?
Arbutus is a tree that once grew in the square, in Soho Square. And when we were researching for a name for the restaurant, we wanted a name that actually had some synergy with the area. So Arbutus was resurrected.
Now, besides being here at Bruno's, what you've been in New York, you've researched all over the place, haven't you? Paris, New York, for exactly what kind of food you want to do here.
No, exactly. Myself and Will were in a fortunate situation post Putney Bridge.
Could you explain that one?
Well, Putney Bridge, myself and Will worked there for close on 8 years. We achieved a Michelin star there also. But it comes to a stage where we couldn't take it any further. We needed a new challenge, and we were pretty tired of the fine dining formality. Hence our reason to take a sabbatical, travel to New York, travel to Paris, eat in London, and decide together exactly what we thought made a great dining experience. Not just about the food, but the whole setup, from the formality side to the wine side, etc., etc. I think too many chefs emphasize solely on the food. I actually think it makes up to about only 40% of a great occasion. And I think the research, especially in New York, confirmed that to us.
Now you like to have a lot of energy in the place. You like to have a lot of style to the place. And how does your food match in with that? Tell us your style of cooking.
Well, the food is predominantly French, but it's got influences from modern Europe. There are some Italian influences, obviously British influences, but it's we try and steer away from the luxury ingredients. Here we sort of, our ethos was to set out and create a menu around 25 to 30 pound a head. And we've done that. I mean, it's a huge challenge for us to actually maintain that, because chefs can get carried away with the luxury ingredients like foie gras, turbot, scallops, langoustines. We kind of try and research all the forgotten cuts of meat, forgotten vegetables, and it makes us work a lot harder.
Some examples of signatures or forgotten ingredients.
Well, there's one particular dish which you'll find in Provence, which I believe we are the only restaurant in London preparing this dish, which is called pied paquet, which translates as to trotters and parcels. And it's become a signature dish.
And more menu highlights?
Well, I'll give you an example. I mean, today we've got we use a farm in the north of Wales where she just supplies us just with every part of the lamb she can. And we've got lamb's tripe on today, mixed with a bit of lamb shoulder, a bit of lamb breast, and we're calling that shepherd's pie. It's our interpretation of traditional shepherd's pie. Pig's head is another one, where we completely bone the pig's head, slow braise it overnight in red wine, then mold it into a tureen and serve it as a starter.
Now, Will, we've got everybody excited about coming here. How does one get a reservation?
Well, of course, over the telephone, I suppose, is the naturally obvious way. Our number 020-7734-4545. That's a London number. You can email us direct at info@arbutusrestaurant.co.uk or visit our website where we have a form which you can complete and forward direct from there. And our website is www.arbutusrestaurant.co.uk.
Is it a tough table? I mean, is business really good?
Business is phenomenal for us at the moment. We would always advise you book in advance. We do always take chance and walk in guests. We have a great area at our bar area where single diners, there's always space there when someone can just walk past and pop in and have a quick plat du jour or a quick bite to eat and a glass of wine. So there's always space for someone in the restaurant. But yes, we are busy and we always advise, if possible, book in advance.
Well, it's fantastic that you're busy. I'm sure you deserve it. Well, listeners, we're taking a risk here with Will and Anthony, talking to them before we dined, but I think we'll confirm for you afterwards that this indeed was a wonderful experience. We're certainly looking forward to it.
Bye.
Well, I mean, I love this place.
And it was.
Yeah, I love this place. Everybody should give it a try. And they're delightful. It's relaxed. The waiters are in blue jeans, aren't they?
And it was packed.
And it was packed. I mean, that's always good, like the full parking lot test.
The most interesting thing, Anthony and Will didn't say this on air, but they said we weren't trying to get a Michelin star at all.
Right.
It was the furthest thing from our minds, remembering that middle or down market, from a pricing standpoint, is exactly where they were positioning themselves. Now, you might think that £25 for lunch translating to $50 sounds like quite a lot,
but in London,
it's almost as economical as a fast food restaurant.
London's pricey.
And a wonderful experience. They have a very good wine program. We didn't get a chance to talk about that on air, but they pride themselves on finding less well known wineries and. Oh, I'm getting a signal here that I'm supposed to not talk about this anymore because we're moving on to something else.
Yes, we're moving on to a place that you went to and I didn't. And let's listen to that.
It's always interesting to explore a restaurant from a different angle. And tonight I'm at the Grill Room at Brown's Hotel in London, and we're going to be talking about this restaurant through the eyes of the man in charge, the maitre d', whose name is Angelo Marasco. Angelo, say hi and let us know, if you would, why you think that you're successful in this business of running a restaurant.
Hello, everyone. Well, I think, first of all, you have to love what you're doing. And I absolutely love my job. You know, when a customer comes through the door, you have to greet them, call them by their name. And above all, I've known some of them for many years. I know what they like, what they don't like. Well, let's face it, if you take your guests to a restaurant, you go there to impress them. And if they come through the door, you call them by their name, or take them to the table, you remember what they like and dislike. most of my regular customers, before they arrive, I got their favorite wine on the side of the ice bucket ready for them, because I know what they like. So I think that's very important, to make them feel, to build a relationship with the customer, give what they want.
How did you learn how to do this? Did you make it up yourself, or did someone else show you the way?
Well, I mean, first of all, I had a very good training. I'm very lucky, because years ago I had a brilliant training. And then, of course, you do experience a different restaurant, you watch different restaurant manager the way they do things, and then eventually you make up your own mind. But I remember when I was very young, when I left Sorrento many years ago, I went to Austria, and it was very difficult to find a job. And I went to this restaurant, and I realized, I didn't speak German, but by the expression of the human resource manageress, she didn't want to know about giving me a job. And I could understand by the expression, she was very serious. And then she looked at me, and I looked at her, I didn't know what to do, I just smiled at her. And she changed completely. And I thought, Todd, you know, what a smile does. That's why I thought, you know, I still bring it up in my training towards my staff, to be pleasant to customers, to smile all the time. At the end of the day, customers goes out to enjoy themselves. And they want to see a smiling place. They want to see pleasant waiters. And I think that's very important.
Now, how you got your job here at Brown's is kind of interesting, because I believe you were at the Savoy for 27 years. And then a new restaurateur came along who shall be nameless, but as a result you decided to leave. Tell me what happened then. I understand somebody heard about that and then they called you.
Well, when I was working at the Savoy, there was lots of newspaper article about what was going on. And Sir Roccoforte, that he was a very regular customer at the Savoy Grill, and I knew him from the previous company. He rang me and he asked me to come and see him, because he was buying an hotel in London, and if I was interested in come and do to create recreate the Savoy Grill at Brown's, which we have done. He said, I remember after I had the meeting with Sir Rocco, I went home and my wife said, have you taken the job? I said, yes, of course I have. He said, how much are they paying you? He said, well, I don't know, I forgot to ask.
Now what does Mrs. Marasco think about this whole thing? I mean, you spend all your meal times away. does she feel that you have deserted her, or does she understand?
No, she understands, because she knows very well that money is not everything for me. I mean, job satisfaction is much more important to me than money at all. She understands. I mean, we were a bit worried in case Rocco wouldn't pay my wages. But the first month, I said, I got something, so I'm quite happy.
Now, we were talking earlier about Prince Philip's chair. Tell our listeners a story about Prince Philip's chair, how you bought this chair for a particular customer because you wanted him to come more regularly.
Yes, there's this particular customer, since he is one of the most regular customers I had at the other place. And I tried everything to bring him at the Browns, and I realized that one day that he felt a little bit uncomfortable sitting there, so I decided to get a special chair for him, and that was a royal chair, ex-Prince Philip chair, and that now he comes very regular.
I understand that there's a guilty part of the story here, that you told me that somebody redecorated the chair because they didn't like the color, but it still has arms, and it's still in the same place in the corner of the restaurant, right?
Unfortunately, Mrs. Polizzi, obviously she's a brilliant designer, she didn't agree. She said that she wouldn't go with the decor of the room, so reupholstered it. She spent £3,000, and I was quite sad, actually, because I didn't like it to change the royal chair. But, I mean, it looks nice, it looks fine now, anyway.
And he still comes and sits with it just as regularly as you want?
Oh, yes, because we are putting a brass plate on his chair with his name on.
Well, that, he sounds like a character.
He was a wonderful character. And
well, we had a great time.
We did.
Yeah, and so, all right.
There's more London next week, the week after.
Yes.
Maybe even the week after that.
Yes,
we're out
lots
to prove,
of London.
We're out to prove Ed Harrell is wrong.
Right.
and he is.
Okay.
And we'll see you next week, same time, same place.
Bye-bye.